Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis. How are you doing today?
I'm well.
I want you to do me a favor. I want you to talk to the listeners. We had a gentleman drive up from Wheeling, West Virginia to come to the restaurants this past week, and which I was very flattered by. I thought that was a very, very nice thing to do.
I have to just a little aside. It is amazing, since we're doing this show, that people come to the restaurant from all over the country. From West Virginia, from Chicago, from
all over the world.
From
Israel.
Australia.
That's great.
Israel.
It's been really terrific.
And keep them coming,
yeah,
everybody.
Yeah, keep visiting. But gentleman came from West Virginia, so we were talking to him for a while, and he told a rather funny story about how he heard about us. And Francis, would you share that story?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting and pretty funny. Turns out that he heard about the show. It was referred to him by a guy whom he heard speak. A guy who, you know, is a public speaker who's in the food business, and it was at some sort of conference, and he was speaking. And this gentleman, who was obviously very into food, I mean, he drove up to the Restaurant Guys restaurants from West Virginia. It's a couple times he's done that now. And he went up to the gentleman who was a speaker afterward and said, you know, where do you get your stuff? How do you, you know, where, what do you, I'm just sort of getting into the food thing. And so he talked about what he reads. And he said, you know, one of the things you have to check out is this Restaurant Guys radio program. This is down in West Virginia. And he was, the gentleman who came to see us was just about to start redoing a room in his house. So he said, you know, I downloaded all the shows, listened to a couple, decided I liked them. I downloaded 50 shows and just put them on the iPod as I painted the room. As I'm listening, this gentleman says, as he's listening, he realizes that many of the stories and anecdotes that this gentleman had told
at the conference
were really our stories. And he said, wait,
but not
like,
just our stories.
No, but in the first person, right. As in, you know, I went out to dinner with Del Groff last night and we had a blood and sand cocktail. Now, the chances of this guy, you know, having a parallel life with me, with all of my friends.
Well, either he was in the room with us and we didn't know it.
It was bizarre. And so the guy evidently, and he said, the more I listened to your shows, the more I realized that, you know, 10 of the stories this guy told were actually things he lifted from you. He's pretending to be you. So they say that imitation is the best form of flattery. We'll take it.
I feel flattered, I guess.
I would like that guy to send me a check, though. Part of the speaking fee, I think, would be appropriate, don't you? But, you know, I have to I am amazed at how many people come to the restaurant from far and wide now, and
I was always amazed at how many people knew our stories, but I guess I know why.
There are other people out there telling them. What we want to talk about sugar beets now.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't sound like a very sexy topic, and well, it's not. We did a show a while back on sugar beets, and one of the things that happened is they've come up with a genetically modified sugar beet that is resistant to Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
Not a sexy topic, right?
Well, what's happened? One of the reasons that Francis and I want to avoid corn syrup, first of all, we believe that corn syrup is worse for you than sugar. The other thing is, there's no way to tell when you're getting corn syrup, and as a matter of fact, in all likelihood, it's coming from genetically modified corn.
Right.
So by avoiding high fructose corn syrup, Francis and I kind of were able to accomplish both of those things by using sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup.
Well, a lot of your sugar doesn't come from sugar cane. Most of your industrial sugar comes from sugar beets. Well, they now have come up with genetically modified sugar beets, Roundup Ready sugar beets. So Monsanto, which makes Roundup the pesticide,
mm-hmm.
Is used. Genetically modified food is generally, the first genetically modified foods are Roundup Ready. And
what we mean by Roundup Ready is that means you can spray these things
with Roundup.
And they'll kill everything except for products that are Roundup ready, be they canola or be they
corn.
So they're
herbicides and pesticides that don't harm the plant. And what this does is it allows the pesticide Roundup to be, or the herbicide Roundup to be sprayed right on the crop. I don't like that. I'm against it.
Right. It's not that unlike irradiating food so that the food can stay really dirty.
Right.
And you can make sure that it doesn't poison you.
Well,
it's still dirty.
Well, the other problem that we have is in Europe, of course, you can't have genetically modified food unless it's labeled as GMO food. And in the United States, we don't have to label our which is why our crops, our genetically modified crops aren't accepted in world markets. But what this means is that yet another area where GMO foods are placed in your diet without your knowledge, and you don't have the ability to avoid them.
Yeah, that's exactly the problem I have. And like I said, there's lots of reasons to avoid high fructose corn syrup, and there are even some reasons to avoid sugar. But the upsetting part here for me is I have no choice. I have no way to avoid this product unless I, at the same time, decide that I want to avoid all sugar for the rest of my life, which, you know, probably wouldn't be such a bad choice,
but
it is never going to happen with me.
Right.
Okay, I love sugar.
You know, but I think that the European model, and I stand by this, I think that the European model of if you have genetically modified products, they must be labeled. I think that's a good one. I don't understand how and there was that terrible website, the Center for Consumer Freedom, which is really put up by lobbyists for large corporations. Center for Consumer Freedom has come out and said, you know, one of the consumer freedoms they want you to have is the freedom to not know what's in your food.
To not label.
You know,
the freedom to not label things.
And they lobby very hard and very strongly against labeling GMO products. And it's insane. And one of the things that's going on now, and we're going to do a show on this, is because of the increasing pressure, because of the current food shortages, the lobbyists for these large corporations are taking this, and I view it as opportunistic.
That's exactly what it is.
And they're saying that, okay, now we need
GMO
foods.
We have to have GMO foods. We have to create foods that will, quote-unquote, produce more prolifically.
And there's really a lot of evidence that these genetically modified organisms don't produce more, but in an area...
And also, not only that, when you start applying all these pesticides and things to the land becomes stale faster.
What they're doing now in the public sphere is saying, okay, listen, there's a food shortage. This is the food we've got. And they're using this as a lever to try and pry open the doors of some of the countries that currently don't accept our genetically modified and certainly don't accept it unlabeled, our genetically modified foods. And they're using this current crisis as a lever to say, listen, you want the food, you need this food, and once that door is open, it's never going to be able to shut
again. I'll tell a quick story. I know we don't have a lot of time, but just an example in my backyard. Okay, I was a little embarrassed the day before yesterday because neighbor came over to drop off her kid, play with my kid, and the kid's in the backyard and sees some lawn grass and is picking chives out of the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, I had a chive plant on my porch that I must have not gotten to before it went to flower, and now those chives are all over my lawn. Well, guess what's going to happen with genetically modified foods?
It's a good story. It's a good story.
Okay, guess what's going to happen? It's going to become part of the lawn.
Well, when we come back, it becomes part of our national lawn, and once the genie's out of the bottle, you don't get it back. Hey, listen, when we come back, we're going to have one of our favorite guests, Eric Asimov, the wine writer for the New York Times, is going to join us. And we're going to be talking about wine, and we're also going to be talking about when it's appropriate to maybe serve wine to your kids at home. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants. And joining us today is Eric Asimov, author, restaurant critic, and chief wine critic for The New York Times.
Eric Asimov, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well,
I love the theme music.
Thanks, yeah, Green Onions. It's really, you know, it had to be something named after food and kind of bluesy
right.
at the same time. Hey, Eric, we love your stuff. And
Thank you.
And I've read your article every Wednesday forever. But I'm sort of new to the blogging world, and a lot of our distribution is through podcast. And so I'm becoming more and more acquainted with how people communicate on this thing called the Internet, or the Internets, as it were. But it strikes me as I read your blog, that really has changed the way wine and food reporting is done. Will you talk to us about the blog? The blog for the Times is called The Pour, right?
Yes. I'm not sure it's changed the way reporting is done, but it's certainly changed the way information about wine is communicated. So there are so many people with firm opinions and a desire to express it that you can basically get a zillion opinions about any particular kind of wine. I would draw a distinction between a tenacious opinion offering and actual reporting, which is something different.
Well, you know, but I think that your point is well taken. But I remember reading from Bill Grimes, from Ruth Reichel, and from Brian Miller, each of them after they left being the chief critic of the food critic of the New York Times.
Right.
They wrote things about how it was just such a grueling existence. It seemed as though they got up in the morning, they wrote about food, they went to lunch, they sometimes went to another lunch, they'd come home, they'd work out, they'd write about
exactly.
food.
Exactly. Exercise for 2 hours just to get to dinner.
And then come back and exercise. And it strikes me that the blog must change your life in a similar way.
I'm not going to – if there's one thing I really don't have patience for, it's restaurant critics who complain about how hard their life is. And, my wonderful colleagues, maybe it eventually drove them to that point. But, it's a great life. And so what if you have to go to another restaurant? It's just it's getting people not to be so envious of you that you resort to that. But yes, blogging, it's for most people, it's an addition to whatever their ordinary job is. And, in some respect, it's difficult and time consuming, but at the same time, my personal experience is it's wonderful to have a place to communicate things that I can't get into the newspaper, and it's great to not have an editor telling me that's enough.
But Eric, also though, the dynamic is clearly very, very different. You post something, a bad experience that you have at one of the Momofuku restaurants,
right,
and all of a
right.
sudden there are 50 responses, 25 basically saying, never go back there, what are you thinking, and 25 basically saying, must be an oversight. Accept their apology and lighten up. It's the world has changed in that way, where the instant gratification of a blog, I think, and the ability to respond.
Well, instant gratification is right, and I think that's one of the pleasures of blogging, that you have people responding to you right away. And sometimes you overlook the fact that, 50, 100, 300 people are responding. And when you write a newspaper article, you don't get that. But at the same time, maybe you're reaching hundreds of thousands of people.
Sure. And they're responding, just not at you.
Yes. Yes. So it's easy to overstate that factor. But I can tell you just in writing the blog, I find myself writing differently and responding differently just because of the freedom of the internet, the ability to kind of write as much as you want instead of fitting it to the pre-existing space. It's a very different thing.
You've always written in a very personal way the articles that you write, from what I've noticed. But it seems like the blog is even more personal. It's even deeper. Is that true?
Yes, I would say that I'm maybe not quite as personal a writer as you may think. And maybe the blog gives me an opportunity to write more about my life. And I can't say whether that's actually well received or not. I thought when I started blogging, people, this is the age of the memoir. This is the age when people want to hear about your life. They don't really care about what you think. And I have found if the number of responses is any way to judge, people are far more interested in in posts that deal with specific issues in wine or food than they are in hearing about my experiences cooking or at my dojo or anything like that. It's a little bit humbling.
When we
should be more interested in me.
When we come back on the other side, I we're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back. I want to talk about some place where your personal life did kind of an issue that you faced in your family did come to the fore, and we wrote about in the print column about when it's appropriate to and the choices we all make about when it's appropriate to let our kids have a drink of wine or a taste of wine at home. We'll be back and talk about that with Eric Asimov in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Captain Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Eric Asimov, Chief Wine Critic of the New York Times. Eric, you wrote a great article which was sort of prompted us to ask you to come back on the show to discuss. You dealt with in an article in the Times whether and when it's appropriate to share with your kids who are underage wine and how that's dealt with in our culture and other cultures. You want to talk to us about that issue?
Yeah. It's something that is meaningful to me because I've got two teenage boys, and I had just assumed I would introduce them to wine at the table. We drink wine with dinner most nights. And around that time, my wife had gone to a seminar at one of the local schools in which they had gotten together some experts in drugs and alcohol. And they talked about the dangers of binge drinking and the dangers of protecting your children from this and how the human brain doesn't fully form until 25 and how catastrophic this sort of behavior can be. And she was really shaken. And I thought, well, you know, I got to find out what the real story is here, because I would hate to deprive my kids of learning about this pleasure. And so I talked to a bunch of psychologists, health experts, and I found that without minimizing the dangers, the real dangers of binge drinking and that sort of behavior for teenagers and college students, that almost without exception, these experts all felt that it was really a smart thing to introduce teenagers to wine in the proper context, but only if all certain conditions are true. For example, if there's no alcoholism in your family, if there's no violence in your family, if the point of wine is as a beverage accompanying dinner rather than to somehow relax and become more uninhibited. I really felt as if our culture spends so much time thinking of wine as just as alcohol.
Right, an alcohol vehicle.
As opposed
right.
to food.
And dealing with the real dangers of abuse, that we don't think about how to introduce safe enjoyment of wine as a food.
Well, after the news, we're going to pick this conversation up and talk about how, you know, some people do recommend complete abstinence till 21, and I don't see how that could be responsible. You know, we're not talking about sharing a full glass of wine with the kid, and we're not talking about giving them just a little bit of your Jell-O shot either. We're talking about introducing it as food, but we'll pick that up on the other side.
There was a great study at the University of Missouri that we're going to talk about.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, we're talking with Eric Asimov. He is an author and restaurant critic and also the chief wine critic for the New York Times. You can read his column every Wednesday, as we do. If you want to be informed about wine, you should probably do that. And we're talking about a topic Eric raised in a recent article about when it's appropriate or when it's maybe not appropriate to introduce your underage kids at home to wine. Eric, did you get any sense of where it's – is it illegal anywhere to do that?
It probably is, although laws differ from state to state and everybody is reluctant to give a definitive answer. In New York, for example, it may be illegal to give your kid a sip of wine at a restaurant in a public place. It's not illegal in the home, but it may be illegal to give the neighbor kid a sip of wine. So it's a little bit vague, and it's worth checking out.
Well, in New Jersey, it's illegal to give your kid a sip of wine in a restaurant.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, being restaurateurs, that's a thorny issue.
Very
sometimes.
Very big sticking point. I believe you should be able to give your kid wine if you want to.
But I'm not going to lose my liquor license over it.
Right.
So.
Right. What can you do?
Well, you know, and it's funny because we've gotten into it with some pretty high ticket customers. We've had to confront that issue. And it's really thorny when someone's spending a few hundred dollars on a bottle of wine in your restaurant and you say, I'm sorry, you can't give that to your kid, but that's the law. But speaking of other cultures, I mean, if we survey a lot of European cultures, I remember I went to Spain when I was just out of college. And if you were – and I remember in Mark and I, when we turned 21 here at Rutgers, you know, we went out and drank too much.
It was a drink fest.
It was a rite of passage on a 21st
birthday. Well, you know,
birthday.
One of the psychiatrists I spoke to said that the 21st birthday is the most dangerous day in a kid's life because of the tendency to go all out and celebrate. And his thought was that if you were introduced in a responsible way to the pleasures of wine, maybe you would be less inclined on that day to seize this forbidden fruit.
You know, before the break, I referenced a Missouri study that shocked me, and I'm not easily shocked about these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
4 out of 5 21-year-olds on their 21st birthday consumed alcohol. Okay, that I thought that was reasonable. Of the men responding, 34% reported drinking 21 or more drinks that day. One-third of the men. To me, the next statistic was even crazier. Of the women, 24% reported drinking 21 or more drinks. Talking about a smaller human being, a quarter of the women at the University of Missouri drank 21 or more drinks on their 21st birthday.
Which would raise your blood alcohol level to at least 3 times the legal limit for driving. And, you know, in Spain, my time in Spain, if you were 21 years old and you were drunk at a bar or drunk at a party, you were looked down upon. That's nothing you would do in you know, Spain is my example, but in a lot of European cultures.
Well, mm-hmm. You know, there's some of the studies have shown a kind of a divergence in these cultures. There are cultures like the Italian culture in which wine drinking is encouraged at the dinner table, but any sort of drunkenness is
frowned upon.
There are other cultures where it's not, you're not permitted to drink in the house, but you're encouraged to go to a bar and get drunk. It's seen as a manly thing. And, you know, one study followed dozens of people in Boston from the 1940s, I guess for 20 years, and you know, saw this difference in immigrant households. And, you know, in our country, 21 is probably the highest drinking age of any culture in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Most European cultures are 16. And, you know, that alone I don't think makes that much of a difference. And it is true that as the consumption of wine per capita decreases in Europe, you have more of a drunkenness problem.
Binging.
But you still don't have that, you know, you don't go on your 16th birthday and get sloshed. You know, that's not a tradition in those cultures, at least from my travels anyway. I haven't seen that.
Well, you know, it's all a part of demonstrating that wine and beer. I don't quite know how you do this with spirits, but wine and beer are foods and are part of a dinnertime ritual rather than some sort of drug for getting uninhibited.
I think that you and Mark and I all agree on this. I guess, does that make for boring radio or good radio? I don't know. I don't know how that works. Could one of us take an opposing opinion for just a moment? But the question is, what happened now? Now you have the blog, so you have a sense of what the New York Times readers, how they react to things. What was the reaction to your article?
Well, first of all, I got more reaction to that piece by far than any other piece that I had done. And I would say 90% of the people agreed with me that introducing your teenage kids to wine would be a good thing. 10% sort of took the attitude of, why don't you just give them heroin and get it over with?
Isn't there something to demystifying some of these things? I mean, my parents.
It was pointed out to me, and this person may have a point that you can demystify wine, but that's not going to help your kid when he goes to college and they're serving grain alcohol punch at the frat party, you know.
Well, I think that one of the reasons that you're more amenable to grain alcohol punches, you sort of, because you don't have any experience with alcohol at all. And if you've had alcohol before, it's just, you know, the stuff made with high C and grain alcohol, I would think it wouldn't be as appealing.
I don't know. There's definitely an appeal to being 20 years old and not being around your parents and being able to let your hair down, as it were.
I think that's part of the
issue.
I think that, it can't hurt to demonstrate to kids that there's a pleasure involved in enjoying wine or beer as a food and not letting things get out of hand. In a sense, you're modeling.
Right. You're setting an example for your kids. You're creating a counterpoint to the point they're going to see in college.
That's right.
When we come back, I want to talk about where a lot of kids encounter wine for the first time. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and the first time I had a sip of wine was at communion. And we just came have Passover, where, you know, at a Seder is where a lot of Jewish kids will have wine for the first time. And I want to talk about that, and then I want to take that into kosher wines as well. But we'll be back in just a moment with Eric Asimov, chief wine critic of the New York Times. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:43. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by-the-glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years' experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're speaking with Eric Asimov, chief wine critic for the New York Times. And we were talking about wine at home. It seems like a natural progression to talk about Passover. You wrote an article recently about kosher wines, and it was entitled, "You Don't Have to Be Jewish to Love Them." How sweet. Talk to us about wine at home, and then let's talk about the state of kosher wines today.
Well, actually, the piece was about Israeli wines, but there was the larger point about kosher wines, and that is that there so many wines are kosher these days, and from all over the world, that you know it's just a different universe from when those of us who are Jewish grew up with Manischewitz.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you really do not have to compromise. It's not as if you know, nowadays you have to look hard for kosher wines, and even people who don't care one way or the other can enjoy wines regardless of whether it's kosher or not.
Well, will you talk to us about what makes a wine kosher and why were they so of so poor quality for so long?
Well, there are two things that can make a wine kosher. One is if you follow biblical or Talmudic guidelines, in which the wine is only touched by observant Jews, and there are certain things that you have to do in the vineyard and so on. And wines like these are identical with non-kosher wines, but for the blessing. The only problem is that if the kosher element means something to you, it's very difficult to ensure that only observant hands have touched the wine on its journey to the glass. The more common method is known as mavushal, and that is where you flash pasteurize the wine. And this it can never have a beneficial effect
right,
on the wine to heat it up like that.
Basically, boiling the wine is bad for it almost always.
You know, the difference is that in the old days, they actually did boil the wine. Now they very quickly bring it up to a temperature and very quickly bring it back down to a normal temperature, and that has less of an ill effect on the wine than it used to.
Well, and so it's modern technology that sort of made that possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think you'll always spend a little more for kosher wines of a certain quality because it is a little more expensive to follow the strictures. And I remember speaking with a kosher winemaker from California who was talking about how, you know, one of the things that they face, one of the problems they face is they can't do any work on the Sabbath. So you're taking a
right.
day. If that, you know, and agriculture sort of doesn't know it's the Sabbath. So if something happens on you know, Friday night that you needs some tending, it has to wait a day. And that can be expensive to deal with.
And the other thing is that, you know, theoretically you're supposed to let your field lie fallow every once every 7 years,
yeah.
I think it is, and which, you know, you can't do with vines.
Right, right.
You can't pull them out, but in that case they let somebody else harvest the grapes and make the wine and sell it under a different label. But, you know, it's not easy, and a lot of the rules go against what's in the best interest of the wine.
Well, let's talk about another sort of little-known wine that you write about that I adore, that I read about in your blog, not in the physical paper.
Uh-huh.
You wrote recently in your blog about Spätburgunder or Pinot mm-hmm. Noir from Germany. A lot of people don't even know that Pinot Noir is made in Germany.
Right, but many people, Austria Germans, don't think that Pinot Noir is not made in those places.
Well, you know, one reason is they don't use the term Pinot Noir. They use the term Spätburgunder, and, you know, who knows what that is.
Right, exactly.
But, you know, I had just been in Germany and had a bunch of Spätburgunders, and they were just so fresh and thirst-quenching and inviting, and I thought they were really great. They're hard to find in this country, partly because of the language barrier, and partly because you know, they're a very different style than American Pinot Noirs. And I will say that they've also improved greatly over the years, and one reason for that is, I'm sorry to say, global warming,
mm-hmm.
which makes it much easier to ripen these grapes in what's the most northerly wine-growing region in the world.
Well, I think what's interesting is they're even different than, say, French Burgundies.
Yes,
you know, it's a whole classification all on its own. But you hit on a point that Francis and I feel pretty strongly about is we are going to come up with new places that are not necessarily in our lexicon now, as far as places that are going to grow grapes that we're not used to them growing.
Yeah, definitely. Look at Canada. Canada's British Columbia is expanding as a wine region, and they make some really good white wines. There are some Chenin Blanc and Pinot Gris, and you know, I've read about the sparkling wine of England and how it's improved. I haven't been able to test that out because you can't get any of them in this country. But I'm very intrigued by that.
You know, I spent some time in Austria last year with some winemaker friends of mine, and I was amazed at how, you know, first of all, the Pinot Noirs there have been for years excellent, but a really small amount of red wine is produced there, and it's got a real cult following. But you see them once in a while. I'm more familiar with Austrian red wines than German red wines. It's a little warmer in Austria. But they talk all the time about how it's getting easier and easier to produce great red wines because of climate change, because they're getting vintages every year that they used to get once every 10.
Yeah, I guess that's the collateral benefit. You see the same improvement in Barolo and Champagne, I guess it's a bad effect. Don't use big words that you can't pronounce. In some of the warmer regions where it's, you know, you're getting a lot of overripe wines.
Well, that's a criticism we hear a lot of Napa Valley in California, that it's getting...
That 10 years from now, you won't be able to grow wine in Napa.
Although it's a curious question, because I've also read studies about Napa. Napa will actually paradoxically get cooler through global warming, because you'll have more of the fog coming up from the bay, cooling it, right, the region.
And that's
who knows? You know, we'll have to see what happens. Right now, I think the style in Napa, at least, is more of more human choice than climate change. But you mentioned the reds from Austria, and I love the wines called Zweigelt.
Oh yeah,
Really light, graceful, spicy reds that go great with food. And I think over the next 10 years or so, people are going to be seeing a lot more of these wines, more of the Spätburgunders as the prices rise in the more well-known European regions.
You know, it's funny. We have I'm a big Austrian fan, and so is Mark. And we have an Austrian red section on our wine list. And
I love that.
Well, working as the sommelier on the floor once in a while, no one comes in and says, "Hey, you got any Austrian reds?" You know, they're all a hand sell.
It's basically the section of the list that lays fallow every time Francis and I are off.
The coach
every
section.
Seventh day.
But when you sell one, are people satisfied?
People love it. It's like they found an extra finger or something. They didn't know that it existed, and it's really good to have it. It comes in handy.
You know, I think that's the biggest hurdle to get. People are very satisfied with the wines they like, and why shouldn't they be? They say, you know, why do we need more Pinot Noir? I love the ones from Sonoma or Burgundy, but it's just it's a different flavor, it's a different style, and you know, if you get past that first hurdle and try it, you might find something that you really, really like.
Eric, and another way to find things you really, really like is to read Eric's column every Wednesday in the New York Times.
Eric, we had an article that we were supposed to talk about today that we didn't get a chance to, about the difficulty in finding sommeliers. Do you think you can come back some other time and talk about that with us?
Absolutely. Glad to.
That'd be great.
Thanks for coming on the show. Stick with us. We'll talk more about wine when we come back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. You know, you have to read Eric Asimov's column. You simply have to read Eric Asimov's column every Wednesday if you care about wine.
It's the food section of the New York Times, that Wednesday paper, is probably the single most important food column set of stories
section.
That I
yeah.
section. But, you know, more I think almost more important than any of the magazines, that Wednesday food section has... just a core of what's going on in the food world.
Well, and you know, now with blogging, it's funny because I think the big print media like the New York Times still has cachet in a world of bloggers where there are 97 people, thousands of people out there writing about what restaurant you should go to mm-hmm. or what wine you should go to. When you have a blog from Eric Asimov and you have Eric and then the people who respond to him writing on The Pour, which you can find at thenewyorktimes.com, the P-O-U-R is the wine blog, a lot of really good recommendations come out of there, and they carry the weight of being associated with the Times. Mm-hmm. So one of the things people ask are going to ask is, where can I get Spätburgunder? Where can I get Zweigelt? Now, of course, you can come to Stage Left or Catherine Lombardi and get those because we're dorks and we have them on our list. But if you look in the Times, he'll recommend one of the places he talks about is Terroir, which is a new wine bar, T-E-R-R-O-I-R, that's owned by and operated by Paul Greco, who's been on this show, mm-hmm. who has the restaurant Insieme and restaurant Hearth. And I was at Terroir, that wine bar, recently, and I had there's a German Pinot Noir on the list.
Yeah.
And it's pretty wild stuff.
The other thing I like about the column, the blog that Eric does, is he's actually participatory in the blog.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll respond to the responses, which I not everybody who posts blogs does. They don't always come back in and respond to the people who respond to them.
I have to say,
it's conversation.
But then the thing about this blog that I think is so exhilarating to read, but would be to me exhausting to do one.
Exhausting to do one. I actually meant to ask him about that, about how you possibly stay up on it.
I mean, well, it seems like, when does he sleep? You mm-hmm. know, it's this constant conversation rather than you write an article and then the next day you write another article. Too draining for me. I can only handle radio. One radio show a day, 1 hour content a day, that's all I got. Hey, I hope you've all enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.